Do not bring that virus in here. His voice increasing in intensity, one of my thoracic surgery colleagues at MD Anderson was agitated. I am operating in the next room, and I do not want to risk infection. However, this virus was inactivated, not contagious, and posed no risk to other patients. The protocol had undergone exhaustive review by local institutional and federal regulatory committees. In addition, my operating room was sealed. This was one more obstacle to overcome, and it turned out to be the last. I finally convinced my colleague that there was no danger to his patient, and mollified, he left the room. These events took place in 1995, 29 years prior to writing this. The patient, Joseph, and his family were desperate, a situation that, as a cancer surgeon, I had unfortunately experienced many times before. On Friday afternoon, Dr. John Nesbitt, my thoracic surgical colleague, and Dr. Randy Shea, a radiation oncologist, came into my office to talk about Joseph. Joseph had been diagnosed with left lung cancer 1 year ago. It could not be removed with surgery and was treated with radiation therapy. Now, narrowing of the main airway to the left lung was noted on a chest X-ray, and a cancer recurrence was suspected. I had just opened a new investigational gene therapy clinical trial. We agreed that the patient might be a candidate for the protocol and decided to bronchoscope him on Monday, which involved putting a fiber optic tube in his airway to biopsy the suspected tumor recurrence. What was this new clinical trial? For the past 4 years, our research laboratory had been developing ways of transferring genes into cancer cells. A gene is the basic unit of heredity made of the chemical DNA and located on the chromosomes in the nucleus of every cell. For many years, a controversy swirled around the cause of cancer. Are most cancers caused by viruses, or is there a central genetic mechanism responsible for cancer development? As happens frequently in science, both hypotheses were correct, and both mechanisms have now been confirmed. However, one of the major discoveries in cancer research was that the process of malignant transformation is caused by a genetic paradigm for which Michael Bishop and Harold Varmus were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1989. The major mutations detected in cancer cells occur in dominant oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes present in normal cells, not caused by infecting viruses. Dominant oncogenes have alterations in a class of genes called proto-oncogenes, which participate in critical normal cell functions, including signaling and making proteins. Mutations in the dominant oncogenes can cause a cell to go into hyperdrive and become cancerous. There is a set of genes that opposes oncogene functions. These are called tumor suppressor genes and require the loss of function of both copies of the gene by mutation, deletion, or a combination of these for transformation to cancer to occur. It is possible that the modification of the expression of dominant oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes may influence certain characteristics of cells that contribute to the development, growth, and spread of cancer. One of the most frequent findings in lung cancer is the inactivation of the tumor suppressor gene P53 by a mutation, effectively disabling the brakes that slow down cell growth. One of our earliest laboratory findings was that if we restored a normal P53 gene to a cancer cell that had a mutant P53 protein, the cancer cell would die. However, putting extra P53 genes in a normal cell had no effect on that cell. This is the holy grail of cancer drugs, a drug that selectively kills only cancer cells with no effect on normal cells, thus having no side effects. Even as I write this, I feel incredulous that our group was able to develop a gene delivery system using an inactivated type of virus called a retrovirus to deliver the P53, carry out experiments that showed the gene killed cancer cells in the test tube and in mice, and establish a process to produce a clinical grade drug, all of which was sufficiently convincing to multiple regulatory bodies, including our Institutional Review Board and Biosafety Committee, the National Institutes of Health, Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee in the FDA to allow us to go ahead with the clinical trial. And all the while I was operating on patients, running and funding a research laboratory, training surgical fellows, and administering a large department.